From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. The history of Southern food comes full circle in a new book by Michael Twitty.
Our ancestors would have won every single environmental award. I mean, they were organic, they were local, they were sustainable, they practiced permaculture, they composted. Those are all modern labels. It's an issue of people who are in exile adapting. Adapting to where they are and figuring out how to make it work.
Ahead this hour, we talk more with Michael Twitty about his book, The Cooking Gene. But first, last week, we talked about how vinyl records are making a real comeback.
And you can go into Cracker Barrel and buy vinyl now, amazingly. Apparently, they sell it in Whole Foods. I mean, you can get vinyl places where you wouldn't have been able to get CDs before. It's sort of incredible how pervasive it's become.
That's Ryan Lewis. He's the president of the Athens-based Kindercore Vinyl Press. And here are your first thoughts. This is John Habdavny of Atlanta.
I've been collecting since the age of 2. I have a rather extensive collection.
Al Effendi writes on Facebook, the best phrase I've heard to describe the appeal of vinyl is, it has the distortion you like. The biggest problem with digital is that a lot of music today is being mastered for highly compressed digital files listened to on crappy earbuds, high volume with no dynamics. Eli Sanders replies, and stay with me on this one, never will a digital file have the same warmth and tone produced from an analog piece of gear, since by its very nature, digital can't do that. And here's why. At the peak volume threshold, analog gear takes the incoming sound waveform in rounds, whereas when that same signal hits digital gear, it gets cut off or what is called clipping. This generally sounds terrible. How'd I do? Was that all right? Okay. We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. Everyone's favorite insect-sized superhero is coming back to the big screen via the Big A.
Hey, Scotty. Hey, did I save your life? Scotty!
Thank you, Luis.
Hey, are we the good guys?
Yeah.
We're the good guys, right?
Yeah, we're the good guys.
Feels kind of weird, you know?
Yeah, but we're not done yet.
Okay, that's from Marvel's 2015 movie Ant-Man. The follow-up, Ant-Man and the Wasp, is one of many movies currently shooting in the Peach State. And here to talk about what's filming in Georgia is Jennifer Brett. She writes the Buzz blog for Buzz.
Good morning.
Yes, Buzz blog for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jennifer, good to see you.
Hey, can I tell you a really big secret?
Yeah, please,
if you
please.
Just promise to keep it between us. When when Ant-Man was filming, this was actually the first movie to film at the new Pinewood Studios facility down in Fayette County. They let me go into the costume shop and see the Ant-Man costume.
Okay, so you saw the costume.
Yes.
What'd you think?
So cool.
Yeah, was it cool?
Yeah.
So that facility, all right, so as big as it is, I've been there once, and I haven't even taken the tour, but
It's big and growing. Yes. It's like a little city down there now, and so many movies have filmed there or been headquartered there, including Captain America, Civil War, The Avengers, third and fourth Avengers movies, and then smaller projects have been headquartered there, too. William H. Macy did a show called Crystal that filmed out of there. So it's not only is it as an incredible facility as far as the studio is concerned, they're also adding, apartments, condos, shops, restaurants that are going to be around.
They're doing retail and residential?
It's going to be called Pinewood Forest when it's all built out. And the idea is that, folks who come in here to film will be able to stay there, eat there, shop there, do what they want. Already, Pinewood has its very own Home Depot on the property. And as you can imagine.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
As you can imagine, they need to build a lot of stuff and they need specific things. And so they literally have their own Home Depot that serves just Pinewood.
Okay, so at the end of the first Ant-Man, right? We get a look at the Wasp's suit, right? Have a listen.
This is an advanced prototype that your mother and I worked on together. She never got to use it. But now I realize that we were working on it for you. Maybe it's time we finished it.
Okay, so I didn't see the Ant-Man. So who were the stars?
So
who's
that was
the
Michael,
Wasp?
That Michael Douglas that you heard talking there, and co-stars Paul Rudd and T.I., Atlanta's own T.I. I got a chance to visit the set, as I said, and got a chance to speak with Paul Rudd and T.I. They were filming they were filming a scene that took place in a van. So they really were in a van in a giant soundstage. And so it took them hours and hours to film this one scene. But yeah, that's Michael Douglas and Paul Rudd. So looking forward to seeing what Ant-Man and the Wasp are up to.
Let's talk about the third Avengers movie. That's Infinity War.
Yes.
That's set to come out next year?
Yeah, and then Avengers, whatever the next one is going to be called, Avengers 4, is rolling now. This brought basically all of Hollywood to Atlanta. So, I mean, you can't swing a cat without finding a Marvel star, which I don't recommend, by the way. It's just a figure of speech. But Chris Evans, Scarlett Johansson, Anthony Mackie, Chadwick Boseman, Benedict Cumberbatch, like literally everybody in
So the
Hollywood.
Band is back together.
Getting the band back in town, yeah. So I've had a few star sightings to that I can tell you about. Benedict Cumberbatch, who is Doctor Strange, he went over and made some flippered friends at the George Aquarium during the Infinity War filming, and got a cute picture of him and a penguin.
Yeah, the Age of Ultron. Which one was that? That was the second film?
Oh, man, I don't want to be wrong.
Yeah, no.
Marvel
second
fans
one.
Will correct me.
Yeah, second film. Let's hear a clip.
Hear that rap.
Thor, you helped create this?
I've had a vision. A whirlpool that sucks in all hope of life, and at its center is that.
What, the gem?
It's the Mind Stone. It's one of the six Infinity Stones, the greatest power in the universe, unparalleled in its destructive capabilities.
Then why would you bring
it? Stark is right.
Oh, it's definitely the end times.
The Avengers cannot defeat Ultron.
Not alone.
That is such a star cast.
Yes.
And they're hanging out in the Atlanta area.
Yeah.
That's just kind of one of the coolest things I've heard in a while.
And they hang out together a lot. Scarlett Johansson and Chris Evans just, you know, happened to be in town at the same time and have been spotted at places such as STK and at Chops. And so if you're out and about, you just never know who you might run into.
So the FX show Atlanta, right? It's filming its second season right now. I know you've got some thoughts on that.
Picked up some hardware at the Emmys.
That's right. Let's listen to a clip from the first season.
I'm sorry, who is this dude?
Darius, no, man.
That's
we
we're talking
there,
right here.
When you first walked in, I gave you a cookie.
No, yeah, I remember who you are. Look, I'm not asking for money.
You should be. Ain't you homeless?
Not real homeless. I'm not using a rat as a phone or something.
Don't be racist, man. Look, that make you schizophrenic. That don't make you homeless.
Wait, not if it worked, man.
A nice night at the Emmys, right?
Yeah, you know, Donald Glover grew up in Stone Mountain and took home a couple of trophies from the Emmys. This has been a real breakout hit for FX, and it's great to see this show that's filmed here, set here, and pays such close attention to all of Atlanta.
If I remember correctly, there was the first season, and then there was a bit of a break. And
now they're coming back.
Kevin Hart is in town. He's filming his upcoming film, Night School, right?
Yes. Lord have mercy.
Okay, so, you know, we've talked about some of the issues with some of the stars here in town in the past. We talked about some of Shia LaBeouf's issues when he was filming here. And Kevin Hart is going through a moment right now in his personal life. And I know it's not necessarily the focus of what you do, but when you're covering this beat, you end up having to cover some of the personal travails of some of the stars who are in town.
Yes. Kevin Hart, as many people probably know by now, has been the subject of rumors suggesting some extracurricular activity,
infidelity,
shall we say.
Yep.
He has heretofore dispensed with them and called them nonsense. Then on Saturday night, he posted this very sort of somber Instagram video where he struck this very serious and confessional tone, saying that he was apologizing to his wife and children and had made a, quote, bad error in judgment. He suggested that someone has come to him with a financial proposition and he wanted to get out ahead of whatever's coming.
Yeah, so let's listen to a clip of Kevin doing what he does so well, which is making us laugh and being entertaining. This is a clip from his last comedy about last night.
Women approach that phrase with a tactical strategy normally reserved for an anti-terrorist strike team.
This was no accident. That was an ambush. This was definitely
a disaster. Is it that bad to be the first one to say?
Yes, it is.
Whoever says I love you first
cares more.
Let's just disappear. Join witness protection because you're screwed.
How many films now for this partnership between Kevin Hart and Will Packer?
There have been a number.
My goodness.
Yes, they are a formidable team. They're doing Night School right now. This also stars, by the way, Tiffany Haddish, the breakout star of Girls Trip. And if you haven't seen
that amazing yet, and terrific and funny and wonderful.
I mean, tore up that movie. She is hilarious.
Right.
So looking forward to seeing her there. They also, Will Packer and Kevin Hart collaborated on Ride Along and Ride Along 2, which filmed in Atlanta. Ride Along 3 on the docket moving forward.
Another film. being made right here in Atlanta right now is Tag. What can you tell us about
this
Tag?
This is going to be a comedy. This is an ensemble cast. John Hamm, Isla Fisher, Jeremy Renner, Rashida Jones, Ed Helms, who's from Atlanta, by the way. They play college roommates who get back together, get the band back in town, as you say, to do this cross-country road trip. So that one's going to be funny. You're going to see a lot of Atlanta suburban locations because they in the movie they are going cross-country, and so they got to find lots of different locations. So see if you can spot your neighborhood.
Well, that's great. You know, talking about films made here in Atlanta that make good use of the local scenery, and it gives us an opportunity to talk about John Hamm a little bit more.
Yes.
Was last year's, Baby Driver? Well, this year's Baby Driver.
Yes.
Right?
And you know what I found out when I interviewed John Hamm when Baby Driver was just coming out? I didn't know this. In college, he worked as a daycare teacher. He actually had started out maybe thinking he wanted to be an educator. And so that
really?
I guess that was part of his training. And he had such a big time working with the kids and, did so many activities with them. And so I was trying to kind of bait him. And I asked him, how does working with children at a daycare kind of, does that approximate a movie set at all? And he was very gracious and said, they're both high energy environments and everybody's having fun. And
kids all over the place. So movie sets and in his former life. Come on. That's the more honest answer. Right. I just want to play a clip from Baby Driver because it was such a successful movie here in Atlanta and across the country.
I used to fool around with cars when I was a kid. Drive around all night like a speed freak listening to the radio. I used to have my special tape. They have my killer track on it. Get me flying. You got one of those?
Sure.
Well, what is it?
Rotten Rock.
What? Queen?
It was one of the breakout hits of the summer, wasn't
it? Yeah, that was Ansel Elgort you heard there. And I wanted to mention, since you're about to talk vinyl, Criminal Records here in Atlanta is the location for a really key scene in Baby Driver. If you haven't already seen it, it's probably out on Netflix by now or DVD or some such. Mm-hmm. But the director, Edgar Wright, had been at Criminal Records on a previous trip to Atlanta, was so enamored of it, he wrote that scene with Criminal Records in mind. So Atlanta's vinyl scene really resonated with that director.
So generally speaking, folks have complained about the summer box office season. It wasn't very good. It was sequel heavy. Do you feel like folks are getting a bit of sequel fatigue?
Sequel fatigue, maybe reboot fatigue. I mean, Spider-Man, for example, did really well at the box office. But, we kind of have been down that road before, right? So Baby Driver, as you note, did really well. And that was so unique and different.
Yes.
It was the soundtrack was so key and the rat-a-tat-tat dialogue was so compelling. So I think when people go to the movies, they're going to want to see something new and fresh, maybe not another reboot, another remake, another sequel. Although, you know what? What, Fast and Furious 8, how many billions of dollars does that make?
A ton.
You know?
Right?
So
Ryan Gosling
I retract
is coming.
Everything I said. Keep making remakes. Sequels forever.
So Jennifer Aniston has a movie in town?
Jennifer Aniston is back in Atlanta. She has filmed here a number of times in the past. She did Mother's Day. She did Wanderlust with Paul Rudd. And she did Office Christmas Party with Jason Bateman. Now she's back in town in Dumplin'. She plays a former beauty queen turned pageant director. And she's already been spotted here and there. So looking forward to seeing this latest one from Jen.
Well, Jennifer, good to see you. Jennifer Brett, multimedia journalist and buzz blog writer for the AJC. Always good to have you on the
show.
See
you soon.
Friend of the program. Just ahead, tracing the ancestry of Southern food. But first, how one theater in Macon launched the careers of now famous actors. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Failure is a fact of life. We all know it. And we've all been there, whether it's as simple as tripping over your own feet or as serious as dealing with a divorce. Atlanta author Amy Lyle wants to share so people can laugh at and then learn from her own failings in life. GPB intern Zoe Wangstrom sat down with Amy last week to discuss the bright side of screwing up.
Hello, I am Amy Lyle. I am a comedian, author, and recently released a book called The Amy Binegar Kimislau Book of Failures. The theme of the book is everybody has it. Don't hide it. Talk about it. Use it. Laugh about it. Lean on your friends. and move forward from it. Top five failures would be being fired, divorced, falling down in public a lot, no sense of driving directions, probably trying to press upon my sense of humor on people that cannot be impressed upon, for example, my husband's clients that are physicians. I grew up in a very, very poor Appalachia, Southern Ohio area, and it's just you don't look at things the same way maybe other people look at. That was the first person in my family to go to college, surrounded by very, very hard workers, but it does change you. It does make you appreciate things. I think that always stays with you, of the value of a dollar and working hard. I worked at Burger King as a teenager, and I was the drive-thru girl, and I love being the drive-thru girl. I love wearing the headphones, and I love the microphone, and I was, you know, I don't know why. It was very exciting to me to be in charge of the drive-thru. And then they said, can you please take the spatula and take off all the bubble gum of the bottom of the tables? And I said, no, I'm the drive-thru girl. And so that was my last day at Burger King. This boy in college that I was totally in love with, and he was in love with somebody else. And I kind of knew that because our first date, he actually told me that, you know, he loves the look of brown hair and blue eyes. And before I could say thank you, he actually whipped out the picture of his ex-girlfriend and said, my ex-girlfriend has brown hair and blue eyes too. That probably should have been a red flag. But, you know, I was determined to make him love me. And this all came together when I was at his house late, and I went in the kitchen to get ice cream, and she was crawling through the doggy door, the ex-girlfriend, and she was kind of half in, half out. And I was like, oh my gosh. And he drops to the floor and is very concerned about her, not about me. And so then she's kind of stuck in the doggy door. So there's kind of like a jostling of me trying to make a point, like dramatically grab my car keys, like I'm out of here, but I can't get out because she's stuck in the door. So that's just an example of a relationship that went on for a year that should have never, the first date, the first 5 minutes, I should have known this is not the right person for me.
That's Atlanta area author Amy Lyle, author of her newly self-published memoir, The Amy Binegar Chemist Lyle Book of Failures. That piece was produced by GPB intern Zoe Wangstrom. And that last story should actually be on the stage. Theater Macon has been bringing the best comedy and drama and music to Middle Georgia for over three decades. Founding artistic director Jim Crisp has been there the whole time. He's been responsible for hundreds of productions in his 32 years with the company, but now he is stepping down. He will retire at the end of the current season. Jim Crisp joins me now from our Macon studio. Jim, good morning. Thanks for being on the show.
Good morning, Tony. Thank
what
you.
A pleasure to have you on. Did you think when you founded Theater Macon, right, that you would spend so much of your working professional life there, that this would essentially be one of your last stops professionally?
No, golly. The funny thing is I tell most people that when I came to Macon, I thought I'd be here 2-3 years tops. Mm-hmm. Here it's 35 years later. There's something about this community that's special about it. But like most places, it's the people that makes it. And then I started having opportunities to do things professionally that I hadn't had elsewhere.
35 years. How did you do it? I mean, really, what is it that you think you've given to the community? But probably more importantly, what has the community given to you?
Golly, That sure is a two-way street. I worked so hard to build this thing, and you know, once I started it, I thought this is an enormous responsibility. In the heat of the moment, as we were beginning, it didn't strike me that I was starting something that was probably going to take up most of the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Macon has given me the confidence to do things that I really wanted to do, the work that means something to me. It's given me friends and relationships that I would never have had. I've met some of the most extraordinary people that you could meet anywhere right here in Macon. And I've kind of had a magic life here.
Yeah. What was the mission of Theater Macon all those years ago? You started what, in 1986?
86, right. We started out, and as artistic director, my mission was to build a theater that was inclusive, that was more representative of the community that we lived in, and to create a place that was welcoming, where young people could find a home to flex their artistic muscles and energy and imaginations, and where I could also, as artistic director, make choices to do work that I thought was exciting and important and had something to say to my community.
Yeah. Are there shows in the course of your run there that you are particularly proud of? I know it's you know, the question you normally get is, what's your favorite show, right?
Yeah. But right, yes,
let's
right.
broaden that out a bit. I mean, are there shows that you are particularly proud of because you were able to approach material in a way, and some of it obviously is known material, in a way that made it fresh?
Yes. You know, I really hate that question, what's your favorite show?
Right,
because
right.
they're all like my children. It's hard choosing a favorite child. But I loved going back to some of the classics like To Kill a Mockingbird. We were the first theater in Middle Georgia to do that. But I recently went back to it with a different viewpoint. I felt that it was an important story where the heroes of the story are white people, but the background of that story, it was so important that it was that the black community was watching this, that they were present. And you don't often get that sense in a lot of the productions of To Kill a Mockingbird. So I wanted to use a gospel choir as a Greek chorus so that they provided live music and gospel music and commentary as the story was unfolding. And I'm really proud of that production. I thought we struck a nerve with that and found something, found a different way of telling that story that I think resonated with our community very deeply.
Hey, Jim, talk to us about how difficult it is to do what you and your colleagues have done there in Macon. And that's sort of building a really strong, vibrant community theater that is supported by the community around you.
The thing is for, and anybody who's doing nonprofit work recognizes this and knows it. I mean, you're always doing much more with much less than anybody else. And of course, money is always a problem. You do your work with the wolf at the door, always. And you never get over that. You never get over that feeling that this might be our last show, this might be our last season, but you keep forging ahead. And I've always been an optimist and believed that we would keep moving forward. But it's been very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. But what's been wonderful is how this community has embraced us over the years. And whenever I've reached out for help, the answer has always been yes. There have been people in this community who I have gone to for help, whether it be financial or advice or some kind of support, they have always said yes. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because they recognized that we were building something important, something that was contributing not only to the cultural life of this community, but we were contributing something to the economic life of the community because we moved our theater downtown our abandoned urban center 30 years ago at a time when it was completely dead, and people said, don't move the theater there. And because downtown's dead, it's never coming back. And I felt that if this downtown was coming back, it would be arts, culture, and leisure that's going to bring it back. And that's absolutely what's happened. We have one of the most vibrant new urban centers of any city in the Southeast, I can guarantee you. People are astounded when they come here and see what we've accomplished in 30 years. And I'm so proud that my theater has been a part of that, because we planted our flag downtown when people said, no, don't go there.
Yeah. Why now? Why is now the moment for you to step down?
Oh, gosh. I've been doing it for 35 years, and I feel like I've accomplished most of what I want to accomplish as an artistic director, but I wanted to leave when maybe there would be some, when some people would be sad about that. I also wanted to have a hand in choosing my successor, and I wanted to leave on my terms, and I had the opportunity to recognize the talent of a young fellow I worked with, a protege, who's been working with us for the last 7 years as a choreographer and then a choreographer-director. He is extraordinarily talented and gifted in so many ways, and he's young, and he has energy, and he interfaces with the world in ways that I don't understand.
What's his name?
His name is Richard Frazier,
yep.
and he teaches at Northside High School in Warner Robins, and I have such enormous respect for him, and it allows me to step away and having the confidence that the theater is in wonderful hands, and he's as passionate about theater and live performance as I am. He has great ideas, he's only 30 years old, which is great because he understands technology and the use of technology in ways that I don't. He's just extraordinary. He's a volcano of talent.
So part of your legacy is the list of great people you've worked with and launched to terrific careers. Talk about some of those people. Carrie Preston obviously comes
to
mind.
Yeah. I started working with Carrie when she was about 13, 14 years old, and her brother John, her older brother John, when he was 18. And, one of the great pluses of my work and what I do is having had the opportunity to work with, teach, and encourage young, talented people. Now, I knew when I met Carrie and John both that they were extraordinarily gifted. They were amazing young talents. And, of course, it's an enormously difficult business. I was sure that both of them would have professional careers. How far they would go, who knows? But and time has borne that out. I mean, they both have done extremely well. Carrie's an Emmy Award-winning actress.
Yep.
And John's a nationally recognized actor at regional theaters around the country. And it's so exciting to have known them, to have worked with them, and to be a part of their lives now. And think of them as friends first and former students and proteges who now, in many ways, teach me.
Mm. You have been in the business of literally sort of getting people off their butts and into a theater for a live performance for 35 years. How difficult has that become over the years with so many options vying for our attention?
Boy, that's a great question. 30 years ago, it wasn't as difficult.
No.
Going to the theater and attending live entertainment was something that people did. It was ingrained in them. They came up with it. But as our technology became more sophisticated and more fascinating and people became more obsessed with it, we are. We're competing. All theaters everywhere, live theaters everywhere are competing with that. And I think part of the answer to that is certainly programming, finding programming that resonates, and understanding and believing that there are things that we can do in live theater and live performance that film and technology still cannot do. Mm. And I think we look for those answers in the simplicity of stage and theater storytelling. I keep that out in front of me all the time. But, and again, I think It's also understanding how to use that technology to enhance what you do. And that's why I think this young fellow who's coming in is going to really help our theater grow and move to the next level and understands how to use that technology. Yeah. I mean, we have young people on our board and associated with the theater who do things that I can't do, and I have to, you know, I have to hand them my smartphone and say, show me how to do this, you know.
You know, and Jim, before I let you go, I want to give you a moment to talk about a pretty special evening that's coming up on September 30th, I believe. It's
yes.
a special reading. It's a fundraiser.
Yes.
Talk to us about that very quickly, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, John and Carrie are returning to Macon with their spouses. Carrie's husband is Michael Emerson. John's wife is Lizzie, and I officiated at both of their weddings. They will be doing this evening as a benefit performance to raise money for our endowment campaign. We are looking to raise an endowment fund of $1 million so that we can always underwrite the salary of a resident professional artistic director. That's our legacy, and we think that's the way to move
Terrific.
Forward. And it's incredibly moving that they would take the time to come back and do this.
Jim, appreciate it. Great talking to you. What a career.
Tony,
congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Jim
thank
Crisp,
you.
The
thank
artistic
you.
Director. Of theater making, retiring after 35 years. And just ahead, food writer Michael Twitty gets to, well, the nitty-gritty on food history. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, Georgia's Master Chef Junior, and she is smart and adorable. But here's our question to you. Who is the star chef in your family, and what's their best dish? Here's our number, 404-500-9457. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook, and then be sure to tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. On yesterday's program, we talked about how recipes can remind us of friends and loved ones. My next guest traces his ancestry, both black and white, through food. Michael Twitty is a culinary historian, and his new memoir, The Cooking Gene, he asks a pretty provocative question. Who owns Southern food? Michael speaks Thursday night at the Atlanta History Center, and he joins me now. Michael, good to talk to you. Thanks for being on the program.
Well, good morning. How y'all doing?
We're good. We're good. You know, that's a really good and provocative question. Who owns Southern food? What do you say to people who will hear that and want to know? First of all, is that really a question? Is that something to be debated?
Well, we all know who owned black people in 1860, don't we?
Okay.
So ownership is, you know, in a capitalist society, ownership and fences are very important. We're learning that the hard way, aren't we? Mm. So I would say that my answer is very nice and philosophical. And it goes like this. You know, who owns Southern food? Whoever is going to take responsibility for owning its past, maintaining its present, and securing its future in a positive and forward-leaning way. So it's not, for me, it's not about whether your phenotype is European or African or in between or native or anything else. It has to do with your values and how you look at the history of the food. And understand that Southern food is a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah.
But it came at a tremendous human cost. And if we don't acknowledge that and acknowledge the other surrounding issues, economics, health, racial reconciliation, we're not doing our job.
Culinary justice. You want culinary justice. What does that mean?
Well, culinary justice is what happens when people who have been historically oppressed are able to reap the full benefit of their cultural production through food. And it means giving people of color, poor folks. I mean, we're seeing an up. I want to make sure everybody knows that we're already seeing an uplift in terms of poor white Appalachian foodways. And yet, the same issues are there that they are in the African American community in the South. Mm-hmm. Not being able to get, you know, brick and mortar businesses, not being able to take advantage of certain spaces, having that food be represented outside the community in different ways than it is within the community, the lack of support for the knowledge bearers of those food traditions. So for me, culinary justice has a lot to do with quote-unquote race, but not everything to do with quote-unquote race. It affects anybody and everybody whose food tradition is, unfortunately, not a means of uplift.
When you were researching Cooking Gene, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about food, something that you didn't already know, and what did you learn that was surprising about your family?
Oh, the last one's easy. I mean, when you find out that you're related to Oliver Cromwell and Sarah Palin in the same day, it's kind of crazy.
Wow.
Well, you know, yeah, pick one.
Yeah.
You can throw Dick Cheney and Samuel L. Jackson in there, so it's all good.
My goodness. Okay.
So that's something. But other than that, paprika on the potato salad. I think people don't understand how many ways food affects, you know, decisions. For example, let's do a quick run through history of slavery and food. Sugarcane is really the catalyst crop of slavery. So in other words, put it like this: somebody living 10,000 years ago in New Guinea, who every human being has a sweet tooth because that's a natural thing, you know, that's part of our makeup, evolutionary makeup, to look for sweet things, for energy. Mm-hmm. So that person was thirsty. They cracked open a reed that tasted really sweet. They began to domesticate it. The people in New Guinea say that the sugarcane is part of the root of humankind. So there's this thing where the food becomes part of the family tree. So if you're Native American, it's corn. If you're from Eastern Nigeria, where the ancestors of 25% of all African Americans came from, mm-hmm. it's the yam. But just that idea that one day someone had a sweet tooth, and that plant crossed the globe, and eventually led to, let's grow a lot of that.
Yeah,
Native Americans won't be our enslaved people. Let's go get Africans, and that's when the story begins.
So, Michael, this is amazing to me. So, as a person who doesn't view food, and I see this as a bit of a failing of mine, right? As a person who doesn't view food through kind of a historical lens, as symbolic of things, who didn't grow up seeing the narrative of food as clearly as you do, explain to me and others like me what we've been missing all this time.
You know something? It's these what I call food prints. You know, it's more than just... I think the first problem we have is that in our culture today, we rarely get beyond three generations of cultural and familial memory. In the past, even without, you know, literacy, without computers, without digitizing things, people's memory was a lot longer. And so those narratives really sustained people through a lot of tragedies and through a lot of failures. Although listening to the broadcast earlier today, none so glorious as having the ex-girlfriend crawl through the door.
Yeah,
that was hilarious.
Yeah, it was.
I had to remark on that. But y'all should have been there. It was cute. But it really goes down to that. I mean, I'm Jewish also, and people find that to be exotic, and I personally don't. And you know, every year Passover, you know, eating those symbolic foods. But also just the meal itself, people bringing things that have been a part of their family's existence for several hundred years and being able to tell stories around them. Well, as African-American, I do the exact same thing, mm-hmm. You know, that Sunday dinner context, with that reunion context. I mean, these foods have memory attached to them. Why do we eat that?
Right.
Because so-and-so in the country, and we did this, and we did that. Having that sort of... contextual background that you're told by your elders that you can pass on to your children makes all the difference in the world. It is part of the flavor of the food.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Michael Twitty. He is a culinary historian. He will be speaking at the Atlanta History Center on September, when is that? That's Thursday, right?
Yep.
That's coming up on Thursday, 21st of September. And his new book is The Cooking Gene. What do you want people to ultimately take away from reading this book?
Well, I want people to understand it's really hard. that word American is a loaded term for us. And it's not easy to connect to. It's also not easy to connect to the word African. You're kind of caught suspended, suspended animation, like a piece of watermelon and jello salad. And, where do you go? Where do you go? So I went to Senegal in June after doing my DNA. I did multiple DNA tests on multiple relatives. And I was able to find roots in 8 African, West African nations. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
I want people to understand how difficult that is, but how worthwhile it is. And for African Americans, this book tends to be a blueprint, a guide for finding their own culinary story and their own genetic story. Mm. For living history people, it's like, okay, when you do interpretation of slavery, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. And for food historians, people who are interested in Southern food, this is the story from our perspective.
Yeah.
Lend me your ears.
Michael, it's a fascinating read. I'm working through it now. Congratulations. It's a triumph.
Thank you
an
so
achievement.
Much.
Yeah, that's culinary historian Michael Twitty. He is author of The Cooking Gene, and he speaks Thursday night at 8 o'clock at the Atlanta History Center. Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Gucci Mane's life has certainly taken lots of turns over the last year, from getting out of prison to proposing to his girlfriend and releasing a number of albums. And now the Atlanta-based rapper has a new book. The autobiography of Gucci Mane comes out today. His latest album, Drop Top Wop, gives you a sense of how prison life has affected him. NPR music hip-hop reporter Rodney Carmichael has this review.
My name is Rodney Carmichael, and I am hip-hop writer at NPR.
Ah.
Gucci Mane is a very provocative figure in hip-hop.
Metro Boomin' wants some more.
Feeling like I took a perk, I'm at a loss for words. It's like I smoked a pound of herbs, so please do not disturb. Feel like I
Gucci Mane's last year has been a year of redemption for him, I think. Drop Top Wop is his latest album. I really feel like it's his best post-prison album. There are a lot of songs that I like on the album. He has at least one painfully autobiographical song. So on Drop Top Wop, it's called Lost for Words. And unless you really listen, you'll almost miss how dark it is.
She took a mileage, she can't even throw it up on my chuck. Just my luck that I caught a slut. Can't even mutter, fell asleep and woke up. What a model when you came, and she shaped like a Coke bottle. Baby, what's your name?
His flow is a lot more playful and nursery rhyme melodic, but then you listen and you realize that he's really describing what it was like living in such a drug-addled state that he almost lost his mind and could have lost his life.
Like I'm pimp, one day I may not wake up. A description of a young black man tripping with a pistol. Wanna kill like monkey nuts on a Glock 40. I can go gorilla. So off point, he said 12 coming. I didn't peep the signal. I'm feeling like I took.
You hear a lot of repentance in a lot of these songs. And it's not to us, the listeners, like he's definitely not apologizing for who he is by any means. But I think that Gucci is trying to reconcile this destructive person that he used to be with the better person that he's trying to be. And that's kind of hard to do when so much of the image that you've constructed for yourself is built on that reputation.
Like I drunk upon a serpent, snorted a half a bird. Can't even find the words, I'm so at a loss for words.
Huh. I like a song titled Dance with the Devil for similar reasons, because I think he has such a level of self-consciousness or self-awareness And he's really exposing that in some of these songs. So this song is a really provocative song. Hello, Metro on that beat. 100 grand, I'll make a nigga cool, wanna dance with the devil. Get the clothes in the shelf. He tryna dance with the devil. A ghetto superstar, make up, you wanna dance with the devil. As the title suggests, you know, obviously, Dance with the Devil is not a new concept, but as the title suggests, he's kind of talking about the ways that we like to flirt with danger, right? And he's asking, what is it that attracts us to the dark side? And he's asking, and he's posing this question to himself, but he's also using illustrations of, you know, be it fans or, you know, people that he comes across, or, you know, being a former drug dealer and, you know, that whole lifestyle and how attractive it can be sometimes. I make them shoot you clean in your dad hat. Hit you with your trap and shoot you clean out your Hellcat. Everybody wanna be the kingpin, man. The feds snatched them up, now we ain't seen this man. 2017, everybody get high. Take a street drug. Just talking about how we're pulled and attracted to the dark side. He has a line in the song where he says, in every neighborhood, there's a Gucci. The neighborhood dealer with an Uzi. In every neighborhood, there's a Gucci. The neighborhood dealer with a Uzi. Baby started off right as a good girl. Now she trying to act hard like a hood girl. It starts to reveal this kind of undercurrent. Again, going back to that thing that we don't necessarily like to acknowledge or look at, but we know is always there. You know, a lot of times we like to kind of refer to, you know, we put a mask on it, right? We say, oh, that's the boogeyman, and don't look over there and that kind of thing. But you know how that is when you're a kid and you're growing up. That's the thing that makes you more attracted to that thing. So he's kind of looking at the psychology behind what attracts us to the dark side. It's kind of an interesting song. A ghetto superstar make on a dance with the devil. When she glance at the bells, she wanna dance with the devil. I think that a lot of what Gucci is doing and what Gucci represents now resonates with me as an Atlantan. I think, you know, from Gucci's lens, it's the city, it's the town that he grew up in. It's blacker, it's a truer reflection of the culture that has defined where he's from. And that East Atlanta has been overlooked and has now been overrun by people who are not from that environment, that neighborhood, and they look down on people who are. I think it's an irony, an interesting irony that, you know, is not unique to Atlanta. He represents that harsh reality that we don't like to look at, but I think the have-nots, in a lot of ways, are as much a part of any capitalist society as the 1% are. And Gucci is an example of the have-nots selling their story for a change.
That's NPR hip-hop reporter Rodney Carmichael reviewing Gucci Mane's new album, Drop Top Wop. That story was produced by GPB Sean Powers. Gucci Mane's autobiography comes out today. And that's our show, but we want to hear from you. What's your favorite Gucci Mane song? You can call us. You know our number at this point, 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.